please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org. Like what you hear on KPFK? Call 818-985-5735 and press 2 to become a sustaining member. On the line is Sheila Lowe. She's a handwriting expert.
Thanks so much, John. It's always great to be with you.
Always great to talk with you, Sheila.
Well, Friday, September 26th, I attended a day of the Scientific Association of Forensic Examiners Conference. At the end of each day, we had 5 breakout rooms where people could choose different topics that they wanted to attend. And I hosted one on one day that was dealing with handwriting analyzer software and AI, 2 different related topics. And in preparing for that breakout, I did a little research on what experts were saying about AI. One thing that I found particularly interesting was on a podcast called The Diary of a CEO, where the guest was Dr. Daniel Amen, who is a world-renowned brain expert. They said he scanned something like 250,000 brains. And it was interesting to see that he spoke about what he called ChatGPT brain rot. And he's not saying don't use AI, but he talked about an over-reliance on those kinds of tools that they could lead to cognitive decline, reduced creativity, and weakened memory. So it's important to use AI not to replace our own thinking, but to amplify it.
On that note, Sheila Lowe, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you, too.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report, an analysis of education policy and practice that affects our public schools. On KPFK, you hear more than a soundbite. That's education. That's our mission. Please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org. Your local radio station powered by the people. Looking for another way to support KPFK? By donating your vehicle, you're supporting the programming you value. Donating your vehicle is quick and easy. You can always pledge your support at kpfk.org. You appreciate KPFK, and we appreciate you.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Hello and welcome to Radio Intifada, a weekly review of politics and culture covering the whole region of South and West Asia and Northern Africa. We regularly broadcast on Pacifica Station KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and online at kpfk.org. My name is Ankine Antaram and my co-host today is Rana Sharif. Rana?
Thank you, Ankine. Good to be in your company as always. This week marks a week of significance for our people in the Swana region, both in the region and locally. As many of our listeners are aware, while a ceasefire has been signed, the full implementation of such has yet to be seen. In fact, in the hours after it going into effect, an aerial strike in Gaza martyred and injured nearly 70 Palestinians. This ceasefire came just a day after Palestinians marked 2 years of the Zionist regime's accelerated genocide on our siblings in Gaza. Also this week, 2 significant pieces of legislation moved through the California State Assembly. One is considered a win for our local communities, and that is the MENA Inclusion Act, while the other, AB 715, represents a regression of and silencing of pro-Palestinian narratives in K-12 ethnic studies curriculum. Is it coincidental that these 2 pieces moved this week? We do not know, but what we do know is they represent important junctures for our communities locally.
Assemblymember John Harabedian, a Democrat representing Pasadena, introduced AB 91, the MENA Inclusion Act. The bill aims at ensuring Middle Eastern and North African groups are accurately represented and recognized in demographic data collected by the state of California, according to the council members' press release. California is home to approximately 740,219 individuals who identify as Middle Eastern or North African, or MENA, but they are currently classified under the broader white category in federal and state data. Accurate MENA-specific data is crucial for improving state planning, resource allocation, and policy interventions to better serve our community. In response to this gap, the Biden administration had announced a distinct MENA category in the 2030 U.S. Census, and New York has already passed similar legislation. The MENA Inclusion Act, which will require that starting January 1, 2026, state agencies, boards, and commissions in California that collect demographic data on ancestry or ethnic origin must include separate categories for Middle Eastern and North African groups.
So in addition to the MENA Inclusion Act on Monday, which is AB 91 is its official title, it came into effect on Monday, just the day after this important victory, AB 715 was signed into law by our Governor Newsom. Introduced earlier this year by Assemblymember Rick Chavez-Zibor, a Democrat here from Los Angeles, and co-sponsored by the Jewish Public Affairs Committee, California AB 715 is said to be a dangerous weaponization of anti-Semitism to infringe on constitutionally protected free speech and academic freedom in K-12 classrooms. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, Cal Action, California schools should be a place where students learn to think critically, engage with diverse perspectives, and build understanding across differences. But AB 715 would do the opposite, censoring teachers, undermining academic freedom, chilling critical constitutionally protected classroom discussion, and threatening freedom of speech in our public schools.
They continue, "We all agree that anti-Semitism and all forms of discrimination must be addressed in schools. But AB 715 goes far beyond protecting students from harassment or violence. Instead, it polices what can be said in classrooms, subjects legitimate academic frameworks to overly broad censorship, and risks undermining conversations about history, identity, and human rights. AB 715's provisions will dangerously censor inclusive and historically relevant curricula, create a chilling effect on educators and students, engage in constitutionally protected expression. AB 715 is a dangerous bill that risks infringing important constitutional free speech and opens up the state to costly litigation over the bill's implementation."
Thank you, Ankenen. We're very grateful to the various civil liberties organizations and organizations that are committed to protecting the civil liberties and freedoms of our communities. Today, we're here to discuss these two important legislative issues individually and collectively, particularly at a moment when repression and silencing of pro-Palestinian advocacy, anti-Semitism, and anti-Muslim and anti-Arab racism are on the rise.
Joining us today are Dr. Sophia Armen. She's co-chair of the California MENA Civil Rights Coalition and executive director of Armenian American Advancement Network. Dr. Susie Abadjian is Glendale City Clerk and the president of the board for the Armenian American Advancement Network. Rashad El Dabbagh is the founder and executive director of the Arab Americas Civil Council. Thank you all for joining us and for the work that you do. Sophia, I'd like to address this to you. Let's begin with the good news. The MENA Inclusion Act, what is it and why is it important?
Sure. Well, thank you so much again for having us on. Thank you for the amazing work that you all do in the community. We so appreciate it. This is such a wonderful show. The California MENA Inclusion Act is really a community-driven bill. It's a piece of legislation that isn't just about recognition, but is actually about fighting for what we deserve and what we're owed as Middle Eastern and North African people in California. So for a very long time, Middle Eastern and North African communities have been under the white category on state data collection and demographic forms. And while people might think that this is about, you know, seeing yourself reflected so that you can understand and feel, you know, good about our visibility in the world, it's also what we believe as a coalition about getting the resources to our communities who are facing very real threats, who are under very real struggles, and who are experiencing different waves and experiences and issues, especially in immigration, migration, refugeehood, and what's happening in our homeland, right? Which is connected to what's here. AB 91 in specific was authored by Assemblymember Harabedian, which is very exciting, a progressive Armenian from Southern California. And it came together because of a coalition of the kind of leading MENA-serving, MENA-led, and MENA constituency-based organizations in California that made a coalition that for the first time was really a MENA-focused space. So I want to say this because there have been wonderful spaces of allyship, right, that have stepped up in our movements, especially over the last 20 years, particularly in the post-war on terror, backlash, surveillance, criminalization. But really, the full power of us stepping into not only our identities, but our campaigns, our struggles as MENA organizations led by, with, and for MENA people is really the basis of this bill.
Thank you, Sophia, for offering some context. Susie, would you like to add to what Sophia has shared from your vantage point?
Absolutely. So I completely agree. Thank you again for having us. This is a wonderful space to celebrate our win. It's a big win for us. It's a historic moment for all MENA communities. And I just want to add to what Dr. Armin said. I think that this is a long overdue piece of legislation to make our experiences visible. Our experiences as MENA communities have been invisible for a long time. Our experiences of racism, equity gaps in different areas, whether it's in education, whether it's in healthcare, employment, et cetera. All of these things have been invisible. And this is an opportunity for us to finally see what the inequities are. And we know that there are inequities. We know that our communities are impacted because we are experiencing those things in our different spaces. But again, there's no data to back that up. And I just want to give you a little example of what we did in my city, in the city of Glendale. My office was overseeing the Commission on the Status of Women in Glendale. And we got a California grant to publish a report on the status of women in Glendale. And for the first time in history, we were able to disaggregate the data of Armenian women from white women as a whole. And the findings were really shocking to us because this was data that we didn't know before. So, for example, even though it says that the demographic data for Glendale, it says that 60% are white, it actually masks the fact that 40% of our residents are Armenian and probably over 40%. We just are guesstimating at this point. And our report showed that, again, Armenian women were doing less well economically. They had higher unemployment rates. They had less educational attainment than women overall. And also women 65 and up had really high rates of poverty. All of these facts were masked because we were subsumed under the white category. So this bill provided us the opportunity to get this piece of legislation so that we can see the inequities that our communities face that we just have no idea about. So,
because I actually know that Rashad and Susie and Sophia, you've been working on this for now it's a long time, right? So you're seeing the fruits of the labor of like decades of invisible work. And I want to turn my question to Rashad. I remember at one point we were part of a focus group on Check It Right, You Ain't White. And so maybe you could speak a little bit about that history that is informing the work of the MENA Inclusion Act, Rashad.
Absolutely. Both Sophia and Susie gave an excellent explanation of what this bill does. But this is an extension of more than three decades of advocacy, how Middle Eastern, North African folks and are identified in this country. I remember when I first came to this country, before I came to this country, I was applying for college. I was still in the Swana region. And in the college application, they're asking me to identify my race or ethnicity. And it was strange. It sounded strange to me. But from the options I had, Asian made the most sense because Middle East or Southwest Asia, that's in the Asian continent. And then after moving here, I realized when people say Asian, that's not what they mean. Then I had to fill out a census form in the year 2000. And I remember checking other and putting Arab or Palestinian. 2010 census came and I realized that there has been a talks and a movement to add a box for MENA communities on a federal level, but it hasn't been fulfilled. And that was around the time when we had a group of Arab American organizations and advocates who were campaigning to educate the public about why it's important to fill out the census form and check the other box and write in your national origin. So there was a slogan going around. I don't know who came up with it, but I used it, and it was "Check it right, you ain't white." And that encouraged folks and kind of it created like this buzz around this issue and why the census is important, because our communities don't fill out that form. So we use that slogan to uplift the message and tell folks that it's important to identify yourself in the census form. A few years ago, we had 2020 census, and we know that we didn't have a box there, but Illinois was inspiration for us, because a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, the state of Illinois passed a bill to add a state-level MENA category. And I remember looking at Amin, I'm like, my colleague, and we're like, wait, we can do this on a state level. We don't have to wait for the federal government to for the Office of Management and Budget on a federal level to add a category for us. So let's get this done. And here we are.
Rashad, just like you, I remember coming to the United States and being asked to complete the forms and, you know, with racial categories. And it was confusing, and I didn't know which one to choose. And I was told, just put white. And it felt very uncomfortable because I didn't identify as white, but Lebanese and Armenian. And also, I always say I came to the United States and found out I'm white. So
without the privilege.
So how did the MENA population end up in the white category? It erased and disappeared this population in this broad white category. Sophia or Susie?
I think Sophia is the most qualified to speak about
okay.
this.
Sophia?
This is a great question, Akine. I think I'm really glad you asked it, because there's actually a lot of myths around this. And I think it's important for our communities to unpack this history, because history is made in many ways. So before I go into it, I just want to really emphasize what we saw in the MENA Inclusion Act has happened in every single decade that MENA peoples have been in the U.S., have come to the U.S., whether it be as refugees or migrants, they have organized. And so that is actually the space that I really want to frame kind of how we actually achieved American citizenship early on, which was the fight for naturalization. So you can't actually understand MENA American citizenship or whiteness during the early 1900s and late 1890s when this happened without understanding how U.S. race happened at that time. So citizenship at the time was actually defined by an act called the Naturalization Act of 1790 that literally limited American naturalization to only two categories, if you're white or black. And this is important because that was the basis for very real anti-black, right, racism being codified and legislated in this way, right? And white supremacy really becoming the center of American citizenship naturalization as we know it. So I want to give that context, because MENA people are not in a vacuum. This was a state founded in genocide, particularly targeting Black people and Indigenous people, right? And citizenship has a history in this country. And so when folks came to the U.S., and they came in a particular moment that I think is really important for us to remember also, they were coming at a time in the Swana region, particularly in the Ottoman Empire and the Persian Empire, where there was a lot of change happening. Nationalism for the first time and national borders were being thought of. And also, I really want to note, at one point after the first Arab case that happened first, then the Armenian case that happened right after. A series of cases basically happened at the turn of the 20th century that challenged the ability for MENA people to become naturalized because the government argued we were not white. So that's what those cases started as. And this then happened in the context, which very few people name, and is part of my work, that was actually in a mass genocide moment, a refugee crisis. And so I want to name a lot of this, especially in Arab American studies, has been kind of framed around the idea of people kind of moving across oceans, right? And kind of this transatlantic circuits of travel. But I also really want to name actually what is also happening is before the concept of asylum is even invented, which is only deemed important once it's needed for European bodies, right, in World War II around the Holocaust, we also had mass waves of people coming here who literally could not return anywhere else. And so their fight for citizenship becomes enmeshed in that refugee reality. And they end up essentially having to prove to stay here. They were facing mass deportations at the time, back to somewhere that no longer existed, fight essentially on the basis of race that they could be naturalized here. There are several cases that involve that designation, but ultimately what we think of as the census category that we see today originates at that period and has to do with the United States actually denying us at the time citizenship on the basis of race, which then is challenged in the courts by these plaintiffs.
Thank you so much for offering us that really rich history that actually connects us in more ways to the various communities that have been extracted, right, in so many different ways here on Turtle Island. And those shared experiences of oppression and violence, I think, is really important to name as part of this system and the ways in which we understand naturalization. And actually, it also speaks to this concept of race as a social category, right? So it gets weaponized and utilized in different ways as a service to the state. I think it's really important for us to kind of name that, because I think that that's also, we see like these categories as somehow in natural, invaluable, really codified. And I think for the coalition to be very mindful of actually how these are utilities of the state and power, I think is really important and powerful, because then we are becoming strategic in the ways in which we are actually able to utilize these spaces to support our communities. Which, Susie, I would love to hear from you if you could tell us a little bit about the way the MENA Inclusion Act, as you actually mentioned earlier, it's supposed to collect data. And I really appreciate you sharing the example of the Commission on the Status of Women in Glendale. It's supposed to collect data, which is important for the state to plan, to provide resources in different languages, policy interventions. So if you could speak a little bit more about how the MENA Inclusion Act actually promises to do those things.
Yes, there are so many different areas of impact that this MENA Inclusion Act would have. For example, in the recent fires, in the California fires, we know that our communities were impacted, but unfortunately we didn't have the data to show who were impacted and what kind of resources we could get to these specific communities. So that's a very recent and very practical example of how the data would be able to enable governments to reach out to the communities and allocate the type of resources that each community needs. Also in redistricting, you know, we're talking about Prop 50 and redistricting and all of this. And so we know that for us to truly have an equitable process in redistricting, we need to take into account MENA communities, which right now we don't take into account. They're communities of interest, but we really don't take that into account when we're doing redistricting and how we're dividing up communities. For example, Glendale was divided into two assembly districts. So we essentially lost our power to elect a representative that represents the MENA community in Glendale because it was split into different assembly districts. It made it harder. That's one example. Another example is just in education. Again, we know that in Glendale, the highest number of English language learners are Armenian. But aside from that, we don't know how the total population of Armenian students are doing in schools. We don't know what their academic achievement is, and we can't really allocate resources for them, whether it's language support, cultural preservation, which really our schools do, that culturally responsive pedagogy, all of these things need the data to support the students. So we currently don't have that. And also health. We know that our communities have particular health needs. However, because we don't keep data, health data on MENA communities, we don't know what the heart attack rates are in different MENA communities. We have no idea, and we can't really have a public policy, health policy that addresses communities, our communities, because we're not able to do that. So those are just a few examples of what this bill will do, will enable us to do, is to really be able to assess the needs in our communities and target the support that we're providing for the different communities that have been previously invisible. So those are a few of the examples. There are so many other examples, but I just wanted to give a sense of what this would do for us.
And you're listening to Radio Intifada on independent and listener-sponsored KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and streaming live on kpfk.org. Today we are discussing two significant pieces of legislation, AB 91, the MENA Inclusion Act, and AB 715, Educational Equity Discrimination Anti-Semitism Prevention Bill, both signed by Governor Newsom. Joining us are Rashad El-Dabbagh, Sophia Armen, and Suzy Abadjian. KPFK is currently on a fund drive. You rely on KPFK, your public radio station, for independent music, trustworthy news, in-depth analysis, and authentic culture. And we rely on you to keep us on air. You sustain us by your generous donations. You make these programs possible. Whether it's a single $25 gift, installments of $25 per month, or more, whatever you can afford, every listener's financial investment is valued. We welcome all amounts, all are needed. And this fund drive, if you pledge $120, we will give you a gift. Chris Hedges' book, Genocide Foretold, an intimate portrait of oppression, occupation, and violence experienced in Palestine. So if you are not a member of KPFK, or if you are and you would like to donate more, please call and join our community. Call 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, press 2, or you can donate online at kpfk.org. Rana?
Thank you so much, Ankine. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the process of how this came to be briefly, and then the coalition that formed in terms of, one, its passing ultimately, but were there objections of the bill in terms of creating a MENA category? And if so, why? Who would like to start us off with that? Sophia, please.
I was going to say Rashad, y'all, if you want to go. Okay. First of all, it was a really beautiful process. Like Rashad said, many organizations, especially Arab American Civic Council, right, had been part of conversations around how we basically bring to the statewide level, right, what was happening federally, what's been discussed also in our communities. I also want to put a kind of, I think, really wonderful moment of celebration also was, you know, the first kind of popularization of a category that was super intra-ethnic, right, came with a very diverse and different vision of like what we are sold in kind of everyday constructions around what, quote, the Middle East and North Africa is. Also was the student movement, right, around SWANA, which is the term that you all use, which really was popularized now at this point about 12 years ago and came out of student organizing also in California in that way as a radical politic, and was a absolutely tied at the time to the divestment movement and the Palestine movement. And so I want to name that after AACC and several organizations who had been in partnership in different ways kind of came together. And also very important conversations actually happened at a SWANA convention that is now held at the University of California system. And there was a lot of momentum, including, you know, not only intergenerationally, but I really want to name, there's youth momentum, right, about really stepping into our power as communities and deciding to work in joint struggle, which is what, at the end of the day, no matter what we call a MENA category, a SWANA category, right, is about. I think as a coalition, we came together to decide we are really going to show up for each other. And we came up with a mission. We came up with a campaign that had a very clear escalation plan that understood who were the people that it would impact, particularly also the most. I really